Attorney Glenn Maurer of Santa Barbara. Hi, Glenn.
Hi.
And you are a man who, I guess until relatively recently, was you headed the public defender system down there?
I did, for 24 years.
Wow. And now suddenly you've thrown even more work on your head after having retired from that, huh?
Well, no, it's not more work. But I am doing this on a voluntary basis.
Huh. And what kind of work actually are you doing?
Well, we have created a group called the Legal Project, and it's part of a greater group called the Committee for Social Justice. And part of what we're doing is representing people who can't otherwise get legal representation on some of these sort of quasi-criminal matters. They're criminal, but they're treated differently because they're infractions. One of the great loopholes or holes in our justice system is the fact that you don't have a right to a free or appointed attorney unless you're charged with a crime that carries a jail sentence. And governments have figured that out, so increasingly a lot of laws that are minor laws are carry only a fine as a penalty, no direct jail, and therefore the folks receiving these tickets don't have a right to have a court-appointed attorney. And in the public defender's office, you know, that was always sort of galling because we couldn't help these people, even though they sometimes faced relatively onerous consequences. In fact, all the prosecutors learned to reduce misdemeanor cases to infractions to try to deprive people of their right to counsel. That didn't work in most cases, but I understand in some jurisdictions it has. We resisted it here. Mm. But in other jurisdictions it's worked.
Well, I know that in Santa Cruz we have the same problem because our sleeping ban ordinance, the law that criminalizes sleeping outside or in a vehicle after 11 o'clock at night, is an infraction.
Right.
In fact, the city council heralded it as some sort of an advance when they reduced it. Well, it was usually charged as an infraction anyway since it was first formed as an ordinance in 1978, but there was a misdemeanor provision for two offenses within 48 hours. Now it's two camping offenses within 24 hours is a misdemeanor, but it's only used against protesters to haul them away from protests and to kind of tie them up in court when that the misdemeanor provision is never, I've never heard of a misdemeanor camping case actually going to court here. Have you had any misdemeanor camping cases there?
It's an infraction. People don't have a, if it's an alternative misdemeanor infraction, which maybe yours is, the defendant has a right to opt to have it charged as a misdemeanor and obtain counsel that way, and also obtain a right to a jury trial, where if it's a straight infraction, you don't get a jury and you don't get a lawyer unless somebody's volunteering to do it, or you can hire one, of course, but that's
costly.
You know, oxymoron, because the reason folks are violating these laws or charged with violating them is usually because they're too poor to afford alternative housing.
Well, I know in Santa Barbara you've had some really strong homeless rights activism during the 80s. You had the Homeless People's Association, the Homeless Coalition. You had Kit Tremaine, a kind of a wealthy philanthropist, assisting. You had the kind of the focus of the country with Ronald Reagan's summer White House there. You had protests that actually established voter rights for homeless people, and there was a blockage of Highway 101 in the mid-80s. You were around for most of this, right?
I was, but I wasn't active in the movement at that time. I was working in the public defender's office, and that wasn't part of my work at that moment. But yes, I'm aware of it, and it's a pretty nice tradition. Peter Marin, who is involved with who actually runs the Committee for Social Justice, and therefore sort of an umbrella organization for the Legal Project, was heavily involved and still heavily involved in that work.
Yeah, he was. I guess there was even a walk across the country, an actual walk from Santa Barbara all the way to the East Coast. Took, 8 or 9 months, and I think Peter was on part of that walk, if not all of it.
I think he might have been.
And it was, back in 1988, I think. I first heard of Bob Hansen, Nancy McCready, Jeff Hess, James Magruder, all these sort of ancient homeless activists, some of whom are still around.
Well, three of those names are still active.
Huh. And Bob Hansen, I heard, is recently taken to State Street, which is a sort of Santa Barbara's Pacific Avenue, if you were to compare it with Santa Cruz, the main thoroughfare downtown, with signs demanding that public restrooms be opened and the sleeping ban be ended. Is that what's happening down there?
Well, he's trying to get folks to boycott merchants on State Street until the city responds with some more humane alternatives. Bathrooms has been a long-term problem. They're slowly adding a few bathrooms here and there. They're building a new parking structure, and they're going to put some in that. And slowly there's some progress being made there. But he's doing it, and I don't know what the effect is. I know the city doesn't like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that I worked for the Legal Defense Center, which I guess is sort of a precursor to your organization that was operational for a decade or two before it closed down in the mid-90s or early 90s.
That was Kit Tremaine's funding that kept that going, and Will Hastings was the attorney involved in that. They did wonderful work.
Yeah, they were certainly in there, kicking butt. They hired me for a year back in 92, 93 to do some organizing, and we did, we stopped McDonald's from evicting homeless people with such petty things as suddenly instituting time limits for coffee drinking. And of course, we pursued that old bugaboo, the sleeping ban, which I guess Santa Barbara is the rare kind of position of actually having abolished its sleeping ban, the sleeping ban portions of its camping ordinance between 1986 and 1989.
Well, it's actually not illegal to sleep rough in the city of Santa Barbara now. You just can't sleep in a camp or with camping equipment or in an RV.
And I presume you're also not allowed simply to lie down on a park bench, right?
Well, you can do that. You can't be in the park after dusk. Most of the parks are closed after dusk, but you can sleep in other places in the city. It's not illegal.
Really?
No. But they sort of forgotten that. And they were writing tickets for people. And in fact, they were writing tickets for people who were sleeping and even camping in railroad property, which was also illegal. The tickets were illegal because that's not city property and they can't enforce a city ordinance on private property.
Interesting.
But we were able to stop them from doing that.
Because I know that we thought that in 1990, Rittenhouse, I guess it was Hal Conklin, the new mayor, passed a law after there was a long protest in front of City Hall that essentially reinstituted the sleeping ban, which had previously been, you know, after a massive protest in 1986, which Mitch Snyder, the national homeless advocate, had kind of started a campaign, come to Santa Barbara, go to sleep, go to jail under the fig tree, the city council changed the law and said you couldn't camp, but you could sleep,
right,
except, I guess, on beaches, and then afterwards they closed parks. They limited the area. But then I understood that in 1990 that law was, first it was changed by a bad court decision, but then it was actually changed by city council action. That's not the case, huh?
No, I don't believe that's the case. In fact, we met with the new chief of police here, and in that meeting they volunteered that you could still sleep in your car. You can't sleep in RVs, but you can sleep in your car.
Wow, well they certainly told me something different when I was going into court in 1992 in Santa Barbara, but if that's the case, I'm really glad that they've, if not changed the law, it sounds like they've changed the practice, huh?
Well, I think the law is, I've read the law, and it doesn't cover, the law, it doesn't authorize it, it just doesn't prohibit it. The county makes it illegal to sleep in your car or anywhere. Actually, the county has an interesting variation on that as well. You can sleep in your car, you can't sleep in your car, but they do have an exception that says you can do so if it's necessary for your own safety. So a person who's fatigued or tired from driving can do so. That only recognizes that there is, in fact, a necessity to defend, and which is what we've been using fairly successfully in the cases we're fighting.
You know, I'm going to talk to you, I'm hopeful, about this necessity defense. I know that we have in Santa Cruz County, as distinguished from the city, there is a motorist's exception to the camping ban in those small parts of the county where they actually have an official ban. For the entire county, they ban sleeping in a vehicle or sleeping on a roadway or near a right-of-way. So there is a kind of, in effect, a camping ban countywide in Santa Cruz, although it's not called a camping ban. It's only called a camping ban for certain four small zones. But the motorist's exception to this was if you're driving through, you know, and you have to go to sleep, then you can. But I don't think they clearly, the judge I saw the case tried before a couple years ago, and when one of these cases came up, said that this didn't really apply to homeless people. It applied to people motoring through. It didn't apply to people, as you put it, habitating their vehicles. That is considered verboten, and I've never seen in a Santa Cruz court the use of the necessity defense, which of course is not just, oh, if you're a tired motorist, you get to pull over, but rather that if you commit a crime, yeah, you admit it, but you're saying there was a greater evil that I had to do to prevent for which I committed the crime, right?
That's right, and the necessity defense would apply to a person who's driving around and can't find a place safely to go at night and goes to sleep in their car because they're fatigued and can't safely drive the vehicle. It would be a viable defense. Whether the judge would buy it or not, I don't know, but it's legally cognizable defense. If the judge refused to consider it, you'd have a good appeal.
Well, tell us, how often have you used the necessity defense down there in Santa Barbara? I understand from Peter Marin that the courts, or I should say the police, have just kind of written sloppy tickets generally in many cases, so you haven't had to actually resort to this rather complicated six-part defense, which requires proving six relatively difficult to prove elements in each case, right?
Well, you know, the first thing we found, and which was what I suspected, and which anybody should suspect, is that law enforcement has become used to the fact that they appear in court, and there's no, and the opposition is generally uninformed about the law. So they have written some sloppy tickets, as I mentioned. One, they're right, there's an area along the railroad tracks near the homeless shelter, and when that shelter closed, it's only open from December through March, and when they closed, of course, 150 people were put out in the streets, and many of them ended up camping or sleeping along the railroad tracks because it's close to the facility that they get otherwise day services, and they were writing tickets to these people, and we went to court on them, and we're ready to show, I mean, we were to fall back on the idea that this is private property and that they can't write tickets there. They could write a trespass ticket if they had the owner's objection. But we never had to because they were so poorly written otherwise, and we won the cases on other issues. We never got to that level of defense. although we were capable of doing so. In other cases, we have presented the necessity defense, and it's been successful.
Now, how many cases have you actually presented a full necessity defense on?
Oh, we've had about 40 cases of various kinds. We probably put the full necessity defense maybe 3 or 4, 5 times, something like that.
Wow, and were you personally the attorney involved in any of these cases?
All of them.
Wow. And can you give us an example, describe the circumstances of one of those cases and how it went?
Sure. One was a man who was a college graduate, an engineer by trade, and he had a good job here, which he lost when he injured his back, and a severe back injury. And he was unable to get employment. So many of my clients. He's now on SSDI. It's about $700 a month. Over time, he lost any place to live and ended up basically living in a Datsun 280Z. All of his personal property was in the vehicle, and he was in the vehicle out in the Isla Vista area by the university. He's a large man. I would estimate, he's 6'2" or 6'3", and he's probably close to 300 pounds. I mean, the idea that he's living in this vehicle is amazing to begin with. But he was sleeping there at night in Isla Vista. He'd drive around and find a place in Isla Vista and park on the street and sleep there. We went to trial, and they gave him a ticket one night. And we had the trial and showed that there is absolutely no shelter in Isla Vista area. Therefore, he had no alternative housing. And the judge, commissioner, agreed.
And how much time did it take you to prepare this case?
That case, a few hours.
And it took you, I guess, an hour in court, say?
It was a relatively short trial, hour and a half.
Because we have, really great difficulty finding attorneys willing to do the kind of, it sounds like volunteer work. Are you getting paid out of any kind of fund?
Completely volunteer work.
Completely volunteer. What leads you to undertake this kind of vast, it really sounds like a vast effort, because I know Santa Barbara, you had what, a couple hundred tickets last year, a couple hundred sleeping or camping tickets?
That's what the police said. We didn't see that many of them, of course. Many of them are people who just disappear. And that's the rub, of course, is that don't take care of the ticket, it can go to a warrant. And then when the warrant's served, they are faced with jail time. And the defense of the warrant is really harder, because there's really not much of a defense to failing to appear on the ticket. So they end up, maybe they could beat the ticket, but they can't beat the failure to appear. So what we're doing is giving them a chance to appear on the ticket itself and fight it.
Did you imagine a decade ago that you'd be doing something like this now?
Oh, but except, I guess there's something in me that is, most people who work in public defender offices, you cheer for the underdog, and you become angered at power. And as I mentioned, these tickets were badly written, they're improperly issued, and yet most people don't know how to fight them, and they try to fight them, and they don't get much help from the commissioners, unfortunately. We had one trial when one of our very first cases was a man who was charged with possession of alcohol in a park out in Ivy, and the Ivy Parks and Recreation Department regulation. We went to trial, and at the end of the people's case, I moved for an acquittal because they hadn't proved, in my opinion, the elements of the crime. And it turned out that neither the prosecuting attorney nor the judge had ever read the statute and didn't have a copy of it. I was the only one in the courtroom with a copy of the law. And, if that person had appeared by himself, nobody would have pointed out that neither the judge nor the DA knew what they were prosecuting. To me, that's just arrogant and abusive.
So you, in fact, have been informing the entire judicial system by kind of holding them to at least a minimal standard of having the law that they're supposedly sending someone to jail or fining them for. I suppose that since it's an infraction, you don't get to go to jail directly. But, well, this kind of brings me to another.
Yeah, we are making the system more honest. I think that's one thing that public defenders have heard. Done. And I think people have to understand that you keep the system honest by having somebody there to challenge it, making sure that they know that you're watching, and that you're going to call them if they behave badly. The last trial we did was much longer. It was over 4 hours.
Tell us about that one.
Well, that was pretty interesting, and that's one we have on appeal now. We'll be taking the appeal on. We finally lost on this one. We had four charges. We lost three. I mean, won three, lost one. And that one, in that trial, we have two people who are living, husband and wife, living in an RV. He worked as a private security guard, making about $1,600 a month, and taking home about $800 and some dollars every 2 weeks. She has SSDI, for physical emotional disability. It gives her about $700 a month, so they have a gross income of about $2,400 a month, which puts them close to poverty level. And we presented testimony. Well, the case is interesting from many levels. The police officer who gave the ticket actually entered the vehicle without permission. First of all, he knocked on the door and didn't get a response. Then he jumped up and down the bumper to make them, which is a standard thing, I guess, to try to get them, rouse them out, jumping up and making the vehicle move. This was like 7:30 in the morning. And then he went and hid around the corner. And about 20 minutes later...
And we're going to have to hear the rest of that a little later. Maybe Sunday we'll hear that. Let's see here, tape two. Yeah, anyway, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Where the very, very strange spot in your dial. Had occasion to talk to someone who didn't exactly know all the radio stations in Santa Cruz, but there was this really, how do you put it, there's this really outrageous radio station right in the middle of the dial. Well, that's us, folks. We are the outrageous radio station in the middle of the dial. We're Free Radio Santa Cruz. And